The paper is about, just to relate it to the conference theme, it's about, I suppose, what you might call the philosophical tradition of ethics, and about Wittgenstein's hostility to ethics. And what I want to argue, I want to try to argue anyway, is that ethics is nonsense. In doing that, I take myself to be, at least trying anyway, to capture the thought behind Wittgenstein's claim in the Tractatus that there can be no ethical propositions. The basis for that thought just seems to be the claim that value is not accidental. So that's mostly what I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to try and see how thinking that through leads to a different way of thinking about what the possibilities for ethical thought are. So I'll begin, and I will read a bit, and I will talk a bit, and I don't think I'm going to break any records for the amount of time I take, so feel relaxed. I should say, actually, the full title of my paper, before I begin, I think I put it down as Wittgenstein, Ethics and the Limits of Sense, but the full title is Eliminating Ethics, Wittgenstein, Ethics and the Limits of Sense. So I want to try to convince you today to give up a large part of what we think of as ethics, and also to give up the idea that in giving it up, we would be giving up anything substantial, anything of any significance, quite literally. Not because, as Mackie thought, it's somehow metaphysically queer, and not because, as Anscombe thought, we no longer subscribe to a kind of framework of beliefs against which our central ethical concepts gain their currency, but because, I want to say, in my view, maybe one day in yours as well, it's entirely empty of content. It's merely nonsense. Before I even begin to do that, I want to note kind of two difficulties that there'll be, I mean, a lot of difficulties, but I want to note two in particular before I even try and argue this. The first is that just in order to do that, it seems like I'm pretty much obliged to treat some things as being substantial, as being meaningful or intelligible, which I'm then going to want to go on to say are not. They're not substantial, they're not meaningful or intelligible. I'm not going to say anything about that objection now, I'll talk about it at the end, in the last section of the paper. The second objection that I want to just note briefly is that some of you might already want to say, well, this view that ethics is nonsense, is itself unethical. So you might want to object to it already on ethical grounds, and then I wouldn't be able to convince you of anything at all. Maybe that you think that it's abhorrent or it would lead to terrible consequences. I think there's a lot that could be said in response to that kind of thought. I'm not going to say very much of it at all right now. All I do want to say is that it's part of my view that in getting rid of ethics, you're not really getting rid of anything important, at least as I'm using the term ethics. I want to say that what we're going to be left with at the end of this argument, the successful, is all that we really need. Can maybe talk about that a little bit in questions at the end. So, the thought that ethics, or a large part of what we think of as ethics anyway, is nonsense, it's not exactly new. We find it in Nietzsche, for instance, in the Genealogy of Morals, where he says something like, to talk of intrinsic right and wrong is absolutely nonsensical. And, see, I don't really know Kant very well, but it may be that some of Kant's attempts to articulate what's involved in the concept of absolute value can seem kind of self-consciously absurd, and maybe so self-consciously absurd that it could be tempting to attribute such a view to him. I'm not going to talk about Kant, I'm not going to talk about Nietzsche, as you might expect at this conference, I'm going to talk about Wittgenstein. And what I want to talk about is a line of thought from the Tractatus that I think, anyway, contains, in a highly abbreviated form, the argument that I want to try to make at greater length in this paper. So the claim of Wittgenstein that I want to focus on is the claim, Tractatus 6.42, the claim, there can be no ethical propositions. So all those things that we think of as being ethical propositions, they're either not really ethical, or they're not really propositions. I think that claim, I think it's fair to say that it's been widely ignored, and that it's been widely ignored even by most kind of self-identifying Wittgensteinians. One reason for that, if I might speculate a little, is that it is typically thought to be an outcome of a theory of sense, a particularly narrow and constricted theory of sense. It's articulated elsewhere in the Tractatus, and it has this as a consequence. So unless you accept that theory of sense, unless you think it's a good theory, and very few people do, then you have no reason to accept the claim that there can't be any ethical propositions. And more than that, you might even say that if this is an outcome of a theory of sense, if it's an outcome of your theory of sense that there can't be any ethical propositions, then that would, it seems, be good grounds for just rejecting the theory of sense. The hope will become clear, if it's not clear already, is that I think that that is an understanding of the Tractatus. And there's an understanding of the kind of grounds for this particular claim as well. It's just hopelessly wrong. Okay, back to the Tractatus. The claim in the Tractatus that there can be no ethical propositions, it comes as the culmination of a line of thought that begins just two remarks earlier, Tractatus 6.4, where Wittgenstein claims that all propositions are of equal value. Silver is diligently looking it up. That's all it is. All propositions are of equal value. And then Wittgenstein elaborates that as follows. Elaborates on that claim as follows. It says this. The sense of the world must lie outside the world. In the world, everything is as it is, and happens as it does happen. In it, there is no value. And if there were, it would be of no value. If there is a value which is of value, it must lie outside all happening and being so. For all happening and being so is accidental. What makes it non-accidental cannot lie in the world. For otherwise, this would again be accidental. It must lie outside the world. 6.42 continues, hence also there can be no ethical propositions. So since I'm really only going to be talking about this one quotation, I haven't produced a handout with a list of quotations on it. but since I don't have a handout, I'm going to read it a second time. so here it is again. All propositions are of equal value. The sense of the world must lie outside the world. In the world, everything is as it is and happens as it does happen. In it, there is no value. And if there were, it would be of no value. If there is a value which is of value, it must lie outside all happening and being so. For all happening and being so is accidental. What makes it non-accidental cannot lie in the world, for otherwise this would again be accidental. Must lie outside the world. Hence also there can be no ethical propositions. So, there's a lot in that remark. There's a lot that I don't want to talk about. I don't want to talk about the idea that might be suggested here that if you had a genuine proposition of value, that would itself be of value. That's probably true. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about the movement of these remarks, which is at times kind of self-undermining, where you get the idea of a value that lies outside the world, and you get it contrasted with another kind of value lying inside the world. And then it quickly turns out that wouldn't be a value at all. There's no kind of value, so there's no real contrast there either. I'm not going to talk about that kind of undermining movement. I think that's probably relevant to what follows too. It's not going to be what I'm going to focus on. Instead, the only thing that I really want to take from this quotation is just the simple thought that value is not accidental. It seems to be that thought pretty much on its own, is what motivates and serves as the basis for Wittgenstein's further claim in 6.42 that there can be no ethical propositions. So that's what I'm going to talk about. thought that value is not accidental, non-accidental. That thought is almost as old as philosophy itself, you could say. It features, in some form or other anyway, in Plato's Euthyphro, where it plays a crucial role in Plato's rejection, Socrates' rejection, of Euthyphro's attempt to define the good, or the just, or the pious, or whatever, in terms of what is loved by all of the gods. What it means to say that value is not accidental, I think, could be put like this. That what is of value, or what has value, could not be otherwise. If you have something, anything that really is of value, then its value is essential to what it is. So that there's no having that thing without the value, with some other value, or with no value at all. It's to say that in this respect, with respect of value, things could not be otherwise, that it's not even possible for things to be otherwise. So Euthyphro's problem, part of his problem anyway, seems to me, is that if we kind of take his definition as being a definition at all, then it's a definition that makes value accidental to the things that have it. Value wouldn't be essential to what they are. I hope this is kind of familiar, but this is not something controversial, strange. What makes them of value, according to Euthyphro's definition, is just that they're loved by all of the gods. It's just that all of the gods happen to love these things. But if that's the case, well then we can imagine the gods not loving these things. We can imagine the gods loving some of these things and not others. We can imagine the gods never having loved any of these things at all. So that, according to Euthyphro's own definition, what is of value, it seems, could be otherwise, it could be different. It could change from moment to moment if the gods decide to love something else. Or it could have been different all along. And that's what seems to be what's wrong with his definition. It's just that. In saying that it's not possible for things to be otherwise here, it seems to me that the kind of possibility that's at stake is logical possibility. It's from a logical point of view that what is of value could not be otherwise. From a logical point of view, what is of value being other than it is not even coherent. It's not a coherent possibility at all. It's not logically possible for what is of value to be different. But if that's right, then we might ask, well, what is it that's supposed to be impossible? Something that is not logically possible. It's not illogically possible instead. It's not as if there are kind of two kinds of possibility, the logically possible possibilities and the logically impossible possibilities. Something that's not even logically possible. It's not possible at all. It's as if it's not even a something. I'm kind of picking out anything at all, really. If that's right, then what is it exactly that when I try and say, well, this value being otherwise, whatever, what is it that I'm trying to say is not a coherent possibility here? If I want to say, look, it's not possible for things to be otherwise with respect to value, what am I actually saying there? It looks as if whatever I could give you in answer to that kind of question, whatever I could express here, if I'm going to express something at all, then what I could express would be something possible, would be something that, from a logical point of view, could be the case, something coherent. So anything that I could express would not be what I wanted to say. What I'm trying to say is something like this, that to say that things could not be otherwise is to say that there's no such thing as them being otherwise. The form of words that I'm trying to use here to capture a possibility, those forms of words are just empty, despite the appearances, despite the kind of feel. I haven't actually managed to give them a sense. I haven't managed to give them a sense that would satisfy me, at any rate. So the problem is not that there's this thing that we grasp in thought, and it could never be the case. The problem is that we haven't yet identified a determinate state of affairs for us to grasp in thought at all. The problem is something like this, that of all of the ways our words could make sense here, none of them will give us what we wanted from. So, to kind of sum up, the point that I want to make here is that to say that value is not accidental is to say that we can't even imagine it being other than it is. There's no imagining it to be different. There's no grabbing hold in thought of what it would be like for things to be different in this respect. Oh. I think that that's kind of this claim that I'm making is borne out when we turn to particular examples and we try to imagine what it would be like for things to be different with respect to value. So take cruelty, for example. It seems like, go back to Euthyphro for a moment, it seems like it's entirely possible to imagine the gods, all of the gods, loving cruelty. You might think, you know, Sophocles, among others, pretty much made his living from doing that. I've been teaching in Greek thought and literature too long. Suppose what I want to imagine is not the gods loving cruelty, or something that would be appropriate to call. Suppose I want to imagine not the gods loving cruelty, but rather something that it might be appropriate to call cruelty itself being good. Can I do that? What would it be like to do that? Well, I can do this. I can imagine people who enjoy being cruel to others. In fact, I don't even really need to imagine that. I can just read about it in the papers. I can imagine people who take pleasure in cruelty generally. But that, it seems to me, isn't even close to imagining something that you might call cruelty being good. No matter how I imagine someone or some people behaving with respect to cruelty, it seems to me that if I'm still viewing cruelty as I do, as I currently do, then I won't have succeeded in imagining something that it would be appropriate to describe as cruelty being good. Well, what I want, when I want to imagine that, whatever exactly it is, what I want is not something that's going to be available from the outside at all. It won't be available in the way that someone's behavior is available. If I want to imagine something that it would be appropriate to call cruelty being good, I have to imagine, it seems to me, not merely someone else who takes pleasure in cruelty or whatever, but I have to imagine me acting and thinking and feeling in all of the ways that I act and think and feel about things like compassion, kindness, or consideration for others. But I have to imagine me acting and thinking and feeling in those ways about cruelty instead of those other concepts. It would be to imagine cruelty taking the place in my life of something like compassion, something like kindness, or whatever. It would be to imagine the concept of cruelty occupying that kind of logical space, kind of logical space that these other concepts occupy for me. But nevertheless, still being the same concept, the concept of cruelty. If that's right, well, it seems to me that whatever I can get into that logical space, it's not going to be the concept of cruelty anymore. Just won't stand in the kinds of logical relations to my other concepts, or to these parts of my life, my actions, my feelings. It won't stand in the right logical relations, the logical relations that cruelty stands in. Seem to be essential to what cruelty is. So I could say something like, well, cruelty, maybe it's something that one deplores or that one avoids. Maybe it's something that one discourages in others. Maybe it's also something that you sometimes have to be in order to be kind. Something that is sometimes unavoidable if you want to be kind, but something that nevertheless you're going to want to avoid if you do want to be. It seems to me that all of these things, and a lot more, go into making the concept of cruelty the particular concept it is. And so if I want to imagine something that you might call cruelty being good, I have to imagine something that has these logical features of cruelty. But I also, or instead, as the logical features of concept like compassion, something that kind of stands into relation to other concepts. That compassion stands, something that just doesn't conflict with your desire, your inclination to be kind. If I want to kind of preserve the sense in which cruelty clashes with these other concepts, then I can't do this. I can't just focus on the concept of cruelty and imagine that thing being good. It seems to me that I have to do something much more radical. It seems to me that instead of just focusing on that concept alone, I have to imagine a kind of complete reversal of my ethical concepts. To imagine kind of my whole ethical world being stood on its head. And even if I could do that, it's not clear to me that I can, even if I could do that, I'd still be trying to imagine something with one set of logical features, something that connects with my life, with my thoughts and my actions and my feelings, in one set of ways, having a totally different set of logical features, connecting with my life in a totally different set of ways, but nevertheless still being the same thing as before. Well, what is it that's supposed to still be the same here? If you change all of the logical characteristics of a concept, if you change all of the ways it connects with your actions and your thoughts and your feelings, then in what sense are you still dealing with the same concept? My answer is, in no sense would we still be dealing with the same concept. If you change the logical features of the concept, then you change the concept. The idea that you could still be dealing with the same concept here, the idea that there's something you could imagine, it seems to me depends on taking these features of the concept of cruelty not to be features of the logic of the concept at all, but to be accidental accompaniments to it. It depends on taking cruelty to be specifiable in terms of bare valueless facts. Certain kinds of behaviour, certain actions or happenings, they just are cruel. But there's no presumption involved with this about value. I think only if someone thought that could they claim that the concept of cruelty could be kind of reoriented elsewhere in the logic of our lives and still be the same concept. And what I want to say to that possibility is just this, that there could be no clearer sign that a person did not share our concept of cruelty than their willingness to claim this. So, what I've tried to argue is that to say that the value is not accidental is to say that there's no logical possibility of things being otherwise. To say that is to say that there's nothing we can imagine here. That the forms of words that we want to use to try to capture what we think we want, they're simply empty. And I've also argued that claim is kind of borne out when we turn to a particular example and try to imagine something. Imagine something that would be appropriate to describe with the words, cruelty is good. If you want to do that, you have to imagine something that's got certain characteristic logical features, and then imagine it having a totally different, incompatible set of logical features instead, while nevertheless still having the same logical features as before, and only those features. And I think it's clear that there's no imagining anything along those lines at all. So the fact that value is not accidental, in other words, I want to say, is shown by inability to imagine anything along those lines, by inability to give our words a sense in this kind of context. But now it seems to me that line of argument also has the consequence that those forms of words that we think of as expressing the way value actually is. Sentences like, cruelty is not good, or cruelty is bad, or whatever. I think this argument also has the consequence that those forms of words are equally empty of content. Whatever those kinds of streams of signs might say, it will be something that gets its content through the logical relations that it stands in to sentences such as the sentences we were just talking about, sentences like, cruelty is good. But what we've just seen is that sentence offers only the illusion of making sense. It's, for all that we've said, it's entirely empty of content. It's just nonsense. And if that's correct, then what can we really be saying when we utter a sentence that, superficially at least, has the form of a denial of that empty sentence. If we've given no sense to the string of signs cruelty is good, then we've given no sense to his denial either. I'm sure Wittgenstein says this at one point, but the negation of nonsense is not sense, it's just more nonsense. So what I want to say is that we've moved from the claim that value is not accidental to the claim that our attributions of value, X is good or X is not good, are senseless, they're just empty. And what I've argued here about cruelty, I think, goes just as well for our other value concepts. Concepts like compassion, or kindness, or courage, or generosity, or whatever. Insofar as they are value concepts at all, their value is internal to what they are. But all that our words could give us, something that's not internal, something external, something accidental or arbitrary. And that's not what we want. What we want to be able to do, it seems to me, we want to be able to turn around and catch hold of what makes these things of value, and turn that thing into an object about which we can theorize. But all our ways of talking give us something that, if they get hold of anything at all, it's not a feature of the logic of these concepts at all. It's not essential or internal to them. But nothing that's not internal is what we're going to want. So our confusion, it seems to me, consists in wanting to treat something that's part of the logic of our concepts as if it's not a feature of their logic at all. Confusion consists in thinking that what is essential to a concept is not essential to it. And I think it's like a confusion between wanting to say something about the content of a thought, wanting to talk about its form. What I want to say is that this kind of confusion is a characteristic of ethics. At any rate, what I am calling ethics here just is the attempt to round upon the logic of these concepts in this way. What makes something an ethical proposition, for me, is just that it arises out of this kind of confusion. Ethics, conceived as something like what you might call the general science of the good, is nonsense. There can be no ethical propositions in this sense. So I have three more short sections. Yeah, lots of time. So I want to say a little bit about what we're left with in this account that I've kind of been trying to sketch. But first, I want to just return to a point I made earlier and say something about the kind of argument I want to be giving. Because my argument here is not supposed to be this. It's not supposed to be, because of the way meaning is, because of the kind of thing meaning is, these sentences like cruelty is good or cruelty is not good, these sentences are nonsense. My argument's not supposed to be based on any particular theory of meaning at all. It's not supposed to be based on a theory that you're free to accept or reject. Rather, my claim, the claim that I want to be making anyway, is that these sentences are nonsense by the lights of our own shared capacity for making sense of an utterance. My claim is that there is no sense being made here yet, irrespective of any particular theory of sense or meaning. So when I say that the ethical sentences are nonsense, I'm not saying, or I don't want to be saying anyway, that they don't meet certain criteria for sensefulness, criteria that you might then reject. I'm saying that these sentences are entirely empty, as it were, by any criteria you might like to apply, since there's nothing here yet for a criteria to get a grip on. So, on the account that I've tried to sketch here, anyway, ethics disappears inside logic. Not as it were as the whole of logic, but as part of it. What we're left with, once it disappears, are just those concepts that we want to abstract from in creating concepts like goodness and badness. We're left with things like cruelty and compassion, courage and generosity, whatever. We're left with those things built into our lives in all the ways that they are, but without the temptation to think that we can get hold of that, the abstraction, the thing that unites them, and turn it into an independent subject matter for theory. I think that as a picture that fits well with something that can seem like a tension in Wittgenstein's thought or in his life. Between, on the one hand, his hostility towards ethics, towards ethical theory, and on the other hand, his own kind of willingness to engage in certain quite distinctive, I think, characteristic ethical problems, and also with his own kind of notoriously demanding ethical standards. I think that that can seem like a tension, and I hope that this kind of account that I've sketched here gives a way of seeing that not as being a tension, not as being a kind of contradiction. I also want to say that this story captures something crucial to whatever we think ethics is, namely its phenomenology, the sense of what it is like to be in the grip of an ethical problem. It seems to me that the thought that ethics is in this way a part of logic captures well the feeling of being bound by necessities that are somehow inexplicable, or inexplicable anyway to someone who doesn't also feel bound by them, who doesn't share our concepts, a sense of the logical terrain in which we find ourselves. And I think that moral dilemmas can bring this out particularly clearly, since it seems to me that one striking feature of moral dilemmas is that the sense in which there is a dilemma at all is something that can be completely lost on someone. I mean, completely lost on someone who doesn't share the relevant concepts, or the concerns in conjunction with which those concepts arise. So if I think of an example here, I think of Agamemnon and his choice between, on the one hand, sacrificing the expedition to Troy and sacrificing his daughter, Iphigenia. As Aeschylus describes that choice anyway, it's sufficient to drive Agamemnon into madness. And then he finally emerges from that madness to sacrifice his daughter. But to us, to our eyes, to those of us who don't share his concepts, his conception of the necessities that bind him, the logic of the terrain in which he finds himself, his dilemma is just going to seem, as it seems to the Clytemnestra, not to be a dilemma at all. It's rather a sign of moral weakness, some ethical failure. His problem is that he has the wrong concepts. Okay, last section. So I go back to the difficulty I mentioned right at the beginning. Throughout my argument, I've relied at various points on taking certain combinations of words to be substantial, to be meaningful or intelligible. And I've then wanted to go on and say they're not really meaningful, they're not really intelligible at all. So from the point of view of my argument, some of what I've said above must itself be kind of written off as nonsense. And it may be that you might wonder how that's possible. You might wonder whether that's really consistent. Cora Diamond, I couldn't get through a paper on Wittgenstein and ethics without mentioning that. Cora Diamond has described this kind of self-conscious, disillusioned use of nonsense as involving the imaginative activity of entering into the taking of nonsense for sense. And that, it seems to me, is a use of the imagination and of nonsense too, that's taken for granted throughout Wittgenstein's work as being essential to his therapeutic or elucidatory method. I'm not inclined to think that this kind of use of nonsense is especially problematic, though it is very interesting. Entering into taking nonsense for sense might, for instance, involve understanding what someone or other wants to do with their words, the kinds of logical role that they want their words to play, some of which can be imagined along one set of lines, and some of which can be imagined along another set of lines. The problem is not with imagining something having any of those logical roles. The problem is with imagining something having all of those logical roles. The problem is with imagining them combined in one thing, one symbol. Thinking through someone's nonsense may involve drawing consequences that their words would have if they had now one set of logical features and now another. Well, you can have one, or you can have the other. But there's no problem with that. The problem is just that there is no having both. That there's no such thing as the having of both. Nothing that would be that. Diamond, though, in her own account of Wittgenstein's thinking about ethics, also wants to imagine a further self-conscious, disillusioned use of nonsense. One that's not elucidatory, but ethical. According to her account, something like this is true. Certain forms of words, certain utterances, may retain their attractiveness for us, even after we recognize their emptiness. And what marks such nonsensical utterances out as ethical for Diamond is nothing to do with their content. They don't have any content. It's to do with the intention with which they are uttered. An ethical intention. I'm reluctant to criticize this aspect of Diamond's account. Not because I agree with it, but because I don't think that I understand it. I don't understand what it is on such a story that makes an ethical intention ethical, or why certain forms of words should retain their attractiveness for us, even after we see through into their emptiness. And I feel too uncertain about what explanations there could be here to be confident that I've really understood what her view amounts to, or why someone would adopt it. So I'm not going to criticize it. But what I will say is that the whole trajectory of my view, of my argument here, runs counter to Diamond's view at this point. I think the whole trajectory of my argument runs counter to the idea that we might still want to reach for nonsense as a means of expressing ourselves in ethics, despite recognizing the futility or the hopelessness of doing so. As with Diamond, my understanding of Wittgenstein is that he takes ethics to be entirely empty. But my understanding of the reasons behind that claim direct us not to the continued disillusioned use of nonsense in the service of ethical intentions, but as it were back to the sale, back to what can be seen, to our lives, to the features of those lives that we want to build our kind of ethical theory on top of. Ethics, I've tried to argue, involves a confused attempt to round upon those features of our lives, to reify features of the logic of our ethical concepts, to turn them into objects about which we can theorize. And seeing through that confusion leaves us with our ethical concepts as they feature in our lives. And it leaves us with a clearer grasp, perhaps, of how they feature there. In a sense, that's all that it leaves us with. But what I want to say, contrary to Diamond's account, is just that that's enough. I'm going to stop.